Test 1, 2, 3.
This is part two of Who Am I? And I'll flip through some of the slides from last week, just revealing, basically, of course, we open up by showing a lot of slides about people who identify with the body as sportsman, musician, husband, wife, Gujarati, Indian, American, Hindu, Muslim, Jew. There's quite a few slides here of people who identify themselves based on the bodily concept of life. But the... We talked about how the elements, the chemical elements of the body are worth about $20. And then we wondered why people lament when someone dies. If they don't acknowledge the existence of the soul, all you've lost is $20. Certainly nothing to cry over. So there's an inconsistency there. We showed this memorable picture of a $50,000 BMW on the freeway and wondered why they're crying about the dead body inside the BMW, which is only worth about $20. And why don't they cry more about the BMW, which is worth about $50,000? And a number of verses from the Bhagavad Gita, the embodied soul passes in this life from boy to youth and then to old age. Some of the soul passes to another body at the time of death. The six transformations that everything material undergoes, from the itty-bitty ant to the universe itself. We're all born, we grow, we have a duration period, we reproduce, and then we vanish. We dwindle, and then finally we vanish. And the soul is known by its symptoms, just as you get feeling from the top of your head to the tip of your tail, just as consciousness is there. That's evidence of the presence of the soul, just in the same way that even on a cloudy day, the presence of light attests to the presence of the sun in the sky, even if you can't see it. And then, of course, all the different methods of determining the presence of soul and consciousness within the body. The difference between a camera which sees things in a court and an actual panel of judges which are conscious, which judge and which experience and which have emotions. Another verse, that which pervades the entire body should know to be indestructible. No one is able to destroy the imperishable soul. Wherever you see the presence of consciousness, soul is there. People say, they justify the eating of animals by saying that the animals have no soul, and we have a soul, and so we're justified in eating the animals who are soulless, and yet the word animal is Latin for soul. So when you say animals have no soul, you're contradicting yourself because the word animal actually means soul. It's animus. And they eat, and we eat, and they sleep, and they mate, and we mate, and they defend, and they defend. And so there's really no difference in terms of the basic essential activities that we perform in the animal's form. So no one can say that the animals, by virtue of the absence of a soul, the animal's doing less than we are. Practically speaking, the animals have the same concerns that we are. We said the body appears to be alive, just like a car with a driver inside of it. It moves, it turns left and right. It has the appearance of being alive, but it's only because of the driver inside. Without the driver inside, the car is just a useless hunk of metal. And I think we're coming up to the point where we stopped last week. Here's a picture of Gandhi, living Gandhi, who did such a great thing with hundreds of thousands of followers. And here's the same body of Gandhi, which is not capable of even lifting a finger now. So the whole difference between moving a whole nation and getting independence from the most powerful nation in the world and not even being able to lift a finger, the whole difference is something you can't even see. It's so small you can't even measure, and yet it's so powerful that when it's gone you can't even lift a finger. The man who liberated a nation can't even lift a finger. So of the two things, the soul or the body, the soul is the most important. And the soul is described here in the Bhagavad Gita as being unborn, eternal, ever-existing, and primeval, not slain when the body is slain. And the example is given of having a shirt or a coat. It's got holes in it. It's old. It's maybe it doesn't even hang on your frame. And so you just get rid of it and you accept a new one. If you compare the body to a car in old age, when we get elderly, it's like taking a 400,000-mile car to the service station to get inspections and emission. It would be such a costly process, you know, for a car that has 400,000 miles on it, to get it past safety and emission, you might as well just get rid of it and buy a new car. In fact, that's why most people get rid of their cars. The car may still be able to run, but it's no longer safe. And it's too expensive to make it safe. See what I'm saying? There isn't any surgery that will be as effective in giving and fixing all the various bodily parts. There isn't any surgery that will be as effective as just getting a new body. And I read something in the National Enquirer one time. This was a number of years ago, and they had a survey that when you buy a new car, this was maybe 15 years ago, you buy a new car for $8,000. Now, if you were to buy all the various parts and replace the parts of that car one by one, it would cost you $28,000. So better just to get a new car when the old one doesn't pass emissions and inspection. And so that's what happens. Just like we give up old garments and accept new ones, when the body gets old and useless, then we give it up and we accept a new one. And this is amazing. It's amazing when you think all that the soul does. You know, some people have 80-pound bodies, and some of these big football players, they have 350-pound bodies, and they have so much dexterity and so much capability, so much athletic ability, and yet that all comes from that little tiny spark that's inside the body. Not only does it drive this big, huge body of a football player, an athlete, or sumo wrestler, but it gives him or her ability as well. It's not just a matter of breathing and moving. But with practice, you can do this so well and so gracefully. And many people appreciate it. People fill sports stands. They pay $10, $20 a ticket. And there's hundreds of thousands of people just to see the wonderful things that the soul can do with bodies. If you had the same two teams, if you had the the basketball court and you had the LA Lakers and you had the New York, whatever it is, the Boston Celtics, and they were just dead bodies, you know, wearing uniforms, no one would pay to go and see the bodies. But they're really paying to see the soul and all the wonderful things that the soul can do with that body. And so the soul is definitely amazing. Now here's just a list. On the top, on the left-hand side, it says body, and on the right-hand side, it says soul. And here listed are the qualities that pertain to each one. The body is made of matter, the soul is made of spirit. The body is not conscious, the soul is conscious. The body changes, the soul doesn't change. The body is temporary, the soul is eternal. The body dies, and the soul never dies. And then here's another list comparing the soul and the super soul, because many people make the mistake of thinking that because they're spirit, because they're above matter, that they've become God. Some or other, by virtue of transcending matter, they get to be God. And that's a misconception. I'm an American, and the president is American, but that doesn't mean I'm the president. A equals B, C equals B, then A equals C in logic. But it doesn't work that way. Obama is an American, I'm an American, but that doesn't mean that I'm the president. So similarly, I'm spirit, God is spirit, but it doesn't mean that I'm God. There are categories of spirit. There are degrees of power. And so the main difference is between the soul and the super soul. And here's some differences. The souls are many. There are many, and the super soul is one. The soul is a servant, and the super soul is a loving master. The soul is cognizant of one's own body. Each one of us is aware of the pains and pleasures in our own bodies. The super soul, who lives in the region of the heart alongside of the soul, is cognizant of everyone and everything. Every single body is fully aware of it. The soul is infinitesimal, and we'll talk about how infinitesimal in a minute, and the super soul is infinite. The word for the individual soul is jiva. Jiva, very small. And the word for the super soul is Paramatma. Atma also means soul, but Param means supreme or high, or that soul which is above every other soul. Here's the verse. All these verses describing the soul are found pretty much in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. It's a very, very good place to go to if you want to understand reincarnation, the nature of the soul. And when someone near or dear to us passes away, this is where you go to console them that actually nothing has died, but the person that you loved has been reborn. You are going to be unhappy because of not any further having their association, but don't be unhappy on their account. That's just a waste of energy. And this is a nice verse. This verse opens the door to understanding that not only is there life on this planet, but there's life on every planet. There are certain major elements like earth, air, fire, and water. These are called Mahabhutas. And once you know this verse, that the soul can't be cut by any weapon, can't be burned by fire, moistened by water, withered by the wind, then you understand that the soul can live anywhere. It doesn't matter how many millions of times hotter the sun is than the earth. It says here, the soul cannot be burned by fire. It doesn't matter how much less oxygen there is on the moon planet. The soul cannot suffocate by lack of oxygen. It doesn't matter that some planets are more watery than others. In fact, we don't have to go to another planet. We just have to go to Utah Lake to verify that. We can't live in Utah Lake, but there are plenty of souls that do live in Utah Lake. In fact, the carp, there's a certain species of carp that apparently thrives in the atmosphere of Utah Lake. So the soul can live in any atmosphere, and in fact can live in every atmosphere. And so when we look up at the night sky, we don't think that there's just life on earth and all of this is simply a backdrop like to a high school play. We realize that just as we have nations and we have presidents and kings and civilizations here, every single planet has its own version of civilization. Some of them better and some of them worse. And even maybe many of the planets that are described as hellish, in many ways, they're sophisticated. They're sophisticated. They have skyscrapers, they have modern amenities, and that's what makes them hellish, because people forget the goal of life. They're so much absorbed in all the different bells and whistles that they forget the goal of life. And our own Earth planet, you know, sort of borders, you know. You could go either way very easily. You could go in either direction. The soul is indestructible. The soul is individual. Krishna says to Arjuna, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. So Krishna is God, and he's saying, I'm eternal, and that's something we all know, whether we're Muslim, Christian, or Jew. But then he also says, you're eternal, Arjuna, and all these kings are also eternal. Never was there a time in the future when any of us will cease to be. And more so over, they're all the parts of Krishna. Now this is pretty interesting because Mamai Vamsha Jivayaloka Jiva Bhuta Sanatana Manasashtaniani Prakriti Shtani Karshati. Jiva Bhuta means we're parts of God. We're parts of God. And this is key, Sanatana. That means we're always ourselves. The impersonalists or the monists use the example that we're like drops of water, and we, after liberation, we go back and we become one with the ocean. In other words, we're parts, and once we merge, once we get back with the whole, we merge, and we become one with the whole. But the difference here is this word sanatana. Krishna says, yes, you're my part, but you never become one. You are sanatana. You are eternally my parts and parcels. Without that difference between the living entity and God, there's no possibility of love. In India, those who profess the impersonalistic philosophy, many of them worship deities. Many of them do some of the things that we do, but with an entirely different motive. Their motive is ultimately to become one with God. Not to engage in eternal loving devotional service, but just as a temporary expediency to worship the deity, and then their goal is that the form of the deity will dissolve, their form will dissolve, the individual personality of Krishna will disappear, and then they'll just become one. So there's no real bhakti there. It's just expediency. One time in the video, we saw that road in Mayapur. Remember that black and white scene with the devotees coming down the road? That's Bhakti Siddhanta Road. And that road is actually built up quite high because during the flood season, the Ganges overfloods its banks. And that road acts as a dam. It acts as a dam. It's high. So one time, Prabhupada was walking to the Ganges, and he was going down the steep embankment, and he took one devotee's arm in order to get assistance for going down the steep embankment. And when he reached level ground, then he very roughly flipped that devotee's arm away. And the devotee is kind of looking questioning, well, Prabhupada, you know, I helped you out. What kind of way is it to treat me, you know? And Prabhupada, see, that's how the Mayavadis worship Krishna. They worship Krishna in order to become one, and then they throw away, you know, the idea of personality. But we don't do that. We worship Krishna in order to continue worshiping Krishna. We worship Him now as His loving servants in order to get the benediction of eternal loving service. And that's a crucial difference. Na jayate mriyate, birth or death. There is a date of birth for the body, and there's a date of death for the body. Every graveyard that you've ever been to verifies this. But you'll notice here the word na. So there's no birth or death. That does not refer to the body. That refers to the soul. Nayam budva bhavitanavoya, having come into being, the soul never ceases to be. Ajo nityo, the soul is unborn, eternal, undying, and very, very old. Just like you can't say that the sun came before the sunshine, and you can't say that the sunshine came before the sun. It's like the chicken and the egg, only this is even more illustrative. As soon as the sun was there, the sunshine was there. As soon as the sunshine was there, the sun had to have been there. So God's eternal, but we're also eternal. There was never a time when we came into being, nor will we ever cease to be. Sometimes people ask, well, when were we created? No, we were not created. Creation is not exactly the best word to use. We're eternal, God's eternal. We were actually not created, but we manifested at a certain point in time. We were somnambulant within the body of the Lord. And then there was a time when we were meant to manifest our individuality, basically come out. And at that time we decided either to go to the material world or to stay in the spiritual world with the Lord. But we are always eternal. We are always eternal individuals. I think a couple of weeks ago we had a slideshow where we showed a green bird and a green tree. Remember that? So when the green bird flies into the green tree, it appears to merge in the greenness of the tree. But actually it's retained its individuality. So even though we were within God and we were not active for some period of time, it didn't mean that we weren't individuals. We were individuals. And at a certain time, our individuality manifests itself, and our free will manifests itself. And the proof is that some of us misused it and came here to this material world. And some of them... And of course, for us, it's not a misuse, because we had to do it. It's just something we had to do in order to learn. But compared to the ones that stayed in the spiritual world, it might be viewed as a fall down or a misuse. Now, here's a verse I love. Keshaga Satyagabhaga. Kesha... You know, one name for Krishna is Keshava, means who has long, flowing black hair. Keshava, Agra, Shatak, Bhaga. Bhaga means to divide. So if you take a hair and you divide it into 100 parts, okay? And then the next part of this verse, which is not written here, Purna Shatam Shakari. Sata means 100 parts, okay? Sata Bhaga, Kesha, take a tip of a hair, divide into 100 parts, and then it says, Punar Shatanka Bhagi. Then do it again. Take the 1/100th tip of the tear, and then divide that into 100 parts. And that'll give you some idea, just for conceptualization, of the length and breadth of the soul. 1/10,000th the size of a tip of a hair. And yet that soul is so amazing, it powers all of these very, very bodies. So this is something that some Nobel Prize winners have postulated. The discovery of the antiproton. I'm not a scientist myself, so I don't know the deep import of this, but their theory is that there are particles and antiparticles There's matter and there's antimatter. They define it as proton and antiproton. There's spirit and there's matter and antimatter, which is spirit. And matter, proton is matter. The antiproton is antimatter. In other words, matter is temporary and the antiproton is eternal. Matter is ignorant and the antiproton is full of knowledge. And matter is miserable and the antiproton is full of bliss. The matter is visible to materialize, and the antiproton is invisible. It means it's also visible, but you need spiritual eyes. You need your original eyesight in order to see it. And the proton is measurable, and this is immeasurable. Proton is destructible, and the antiproton is indestructible. So Krishna's abode, or the spiritual world, or the kingdom of God, is made of, according to these definitions, antiproton. It's made of antimatter. Matter is temporary, and antimatter is eternal. And Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, that abode of mine is self-effulgent. There's no need of sunlight or moonlight or electricity, but it's self-effulgent in that spiritual world. And we come from that. That's actually our home. Sometimes Prabhupada gave the example that in a pile of rice, the scorpion who wants to protect her young, she'll go and lay her eggs in a pile of rice because the eggs of the scorpion look just like the kernels of rice. And so she doesn't want them to be singled out and destroyed. And so she camouflages them by laying her eggs in these piles of rice. And then if you're looking, if you happen to be looking at the time those little baby scorpions are born, you're looking and then you're apparently seeing some kernels of rice producing scorpions. I mean, that's what your eyes tell you. And so you would conclude that the scorpions come from rice kernels. But that's wrong. It just happens that the scorpion eggs look like rice kernels. The mother scorpion knows that and camouflages in that way. So similarly, the material scientists, they see babies, you know, coming out of mother's wombs, and then they conclude that we are matter, that we are born of, we are produced from matter. But the actual fact of the matter is that we are spirit. And we're not generated from any combination of chemicals or material elements. We're generated from spirit. And matter only animates when spirit enters in. Otherwise, ladies that have miscarriages, they produce a body, and yet because of the lack of presence of the soul, there's no joy, there's no celebration, there's nothing considered to be life-giving. The body is there, but the soul is missing. So it's not simply from the body that personality is generated. Well, this is a verse in the Bhagavad Gita that talks about the eight elements. I give this example in classes, and students seem to understand it quite well. There's a reluctance, a real reluctance in our Western society to give up the body and affairs and pleasures of the body. Because we think that the body is a source of pleasure. If I didn't have this body, I wouldn't be able to enjoy. With the tongue of this body, I can eat nice food. With the eyes of this body, I see beautiful sights. With the ears, I hear beautiful music. If I didn't have this body, I wouldn't enjoy. And so there's a real attachment to this body. And people, church people, you know, they want to have their insurance policy. And so they go to church thinking that when I have to leave this body, then if there's an afterlife, I want to be well situated. But otherwise, we see that a lot of people are very much attached to the pleasures of the body, and they're going to stay here as long as they can until it's, you know, basically leveraged away from them. Among the saints of India and some of the Old Testament prophets and those people who are genuinely spiritual, there's no such reticence at all. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, if I had any love for Krishna, I would just leave my body right now. He said a moment in the absence of Krishna is like 12 years or more. So there's absolutely no attachment to the body there. And in fact, I give this example to kids. I say, if I touch this shirt, did I use this example last time? I don't think so. If I touch this shirt, right, there's a certain sensation there. There's a certain pleasing sensation, okay? Now, if I put a glove on and I touch the shirt, does it enhance the sensation or does it take away from the feeling? It takes away. Now, if I put three gloves on, it promotes it or inhibits it? And inhibit it. Well, what if I put eight gloves on? And then I'm hardly feeling anything, isn't it? So not only does the body not promote sensation, but it inhibits it. Because we've got eight gloves on. Earth glove, air glove, fire glove, water glove, ether glove. Those are the five gross ones. And then the three subtle ones are mind glove, intelligent glove, and false ego glove. So as we go through our body conditioned life, we're hardly experiencing anything. We're hardly seeing. We're hardly smelling. We're hardly tasting. Not to the degree that we would be were we not inhibited and hampered by these eight gloves. So spiritual life, becoming free of the embodied state, is often described as a waking up. It's described as a coming into the light. It's described as a rebirth. It's described that your life, your real life, only begins, you see, when you begin to see it separate and distinct from this material body. So there's great gain, there's great riches to be had if one begins to look beyond this body and the senses of the body. But as long as you're depending on the senses of this body, you're going to live your life in a miserly, miserly way, and you're not really going to invest wholeheartedly and passionately in real life, eternal life, spiritual life. And here's more, you know, all the fibers in there. That's why we do yoga, by the way, Lisa. Because as you get older, all these dry up, you know. You know, and it all kind of, it's like leather, you know. Leather, when it dries, it just like... So that's why we do yoga, to keep it all limber and loose, you know, to forestall the shriveling and the drying up of old age. So I think there's more... No, there isn't. This is an example that's very famous. The chariot of life. You have a driver, you have reins, you have five horses, you have a chariot, and then you have the passenger. So the passenger is compared to the soul, and the driver is the super soul. The driver is God. The reins are the mind, and the chariot, of course, is the body, and then the five horses represent the five senses. So the soul has to be stronger than the senses. When one lives just for sensual hedonistic pursuits, basically you're giving free rein to the horses. Seeing, touching, tasting, smelling. And they're just going to go amok. You'll go over a cliff. Have you ever seen a dog? The dog's sense of smell is very acute. They say that they can smell a million times more than we do. Have you ever seen a dog just running in a certain direction, and then there's a cross breeze or something, and it catches his nose, and it literally just whip. I mean, the dog might be running at 25 miles an hour, and then all of a sudden, a scent grabs its nose, and it just, like, it almost break, it could almost break the neck of the dog. You know, it just whips him around, and then all of a sudden, he's going in a different direction. And then it, you know, so if the senses are unbridled, and that's the exact terminology that's used in the Bhagavad Gita, we will go over a precipice. We will meet disaster. So the reins are the means of controlling the senses and guiding one to one's proper destination. However, if the soul is weak, then the reins will be slack. That's why it says in the Bhagavad Gita that the reins can be your worst enemy or you can be your best friend. If they're slack, they're your worst enemy. If they're strong, and the soul is strong and visionary, knows what the purpose of human life is and where to go, and then he can give the directions to the driver that, yes, I want to become Krishna conscious, I want to do those things, I want to make those choices that make me Krishna conscious, then all the senses can be very, very profitably used to make spiritual advancement. I ask people, you know, when we have tour groups in the temple and the chandeliers are there and the incense and smells of cooking are coming from downstairs, and I say, do you feel sensorily deprived here? And they say, no, you know, there's all kinds of sensations. But because they're in connection with Krishna, all that is gainful, all that is channeled, it is directed and sublimated. Otherwise, without reference to Krishna, the senses will lead us to disaster. And this is an illustration to emphasize that we're pretty much a birdcage civilization. There's a nice gilded golden cage here, and there's a dead bird inside of it. And she's showing off the cage to her guests and visitors. She's so proud of her cage, but she's totally neglected the bird inside the cage. Similarly, we're all about the body in this culture, in this time, and in this age. We're all about manicuring the body. We're all about cosmetic surgery to make the body longer. We're all about anti-wrinkle creams. We're all about whatever can forestall the inevitable dwindling of the body. And we totally neglect that which makes the body alive in the first place, which is the spirit soul. You know. Now, cage polishing. We polish the cage, but the bird's inside. I want some food. Pedro does not have that problem. He does not have that problem. Well, this is a nice little play on words here. We are not gods, G-O-D-S, but we are gods. We are not gods, but we are gods. I believe that because in LDS they use the word interchangeably, capital G-O-D, small G-O-D, they use the same word to describe what we can be and what God is. Sometimes they get criticized by the Christians, the born-again Christians, and there's even one book called The God Makers, you know. And they go out of their way to say, no, we cannot become gods. You know, whatever you think, you cannot become gods. The way to, I think, defer that or deflect that is in the way that we refer to it is a demigod. So you can become godly, you can become godlike, you can become a demigod, but we can't become capital G-O-D. I know even in LDS, and my knowledge is very limited, but I do believe that, you know, the reference is there that you can even create your own universe, like a Lord Brahma. And yet Lord Brahma is also not capital G-O-D. He is also small G-O-D. And in fact, there are many universes, and every universe has a Lord Brahma. And so even the creative universe doesn't make you the creator of all the universes. You see what I'm saying? In fact, there's one story that Lord Brahma went to see Krishna, and that the gatekeeper, he asked, Brahma said, would you announce me to Krishna that Brahma is here? And the gatekeeper said, well, he said, which Brahma are you? And Brahma said, you mean there's more than me? And he said, oh yeah, there's a lot more than you. And then that meant there are a lot more universes in this one universe. And so after Brahma got in, he had talked to Krishna about, you know, how things were going, how the demons and the devotees were going and all like that. Brahma said, may I know how many other Brahmas there are? And Krishna just laughed and laughed. And he called all the Brahmas. And there were Brahmas with our Brahma has four heads, because this is kind of a small universe. It's one of the more recently created universes. So it's not a very big universe. And there were other Brahmas that were much bigger with more heads and so on and so forth. And as a result of that, when he was in that room with all those Brahmas, unlimited Brahmas, with unlimited powers, our Brahma said he felt like a mosquito in a herd of elephants. So we do believe you can create your own universe, and we do believe you can become a Brahma, but at the same time, that's not proof of being the Supreme Lord. Those are gifts that are given to us by God. Simply saying is not enough. One should act by chanting the mantra, Brahma Bhuta Prashanatma. We are one in this is something, you know, when people talk about becoming one with God, we can relate to that. There is a certain oneness that we share with God, but it's a oneness of quality. God is eternal, full of bliss and knowledge. God is spirit. We're also spirit. We're also eternal, full of bliss and knowledge. So in that sense, we're one with God. We don't totally disagree with the monist. There are qualities that we share in common with God. The difference is where we depart is in the added understanding that we're also different from God from a quantitative point of view. We're one in quality, but we're different in quantity. He's great and we're small. It's like the particle of sunshine and the sunshine. They both possess light and heat. But the particle of sunshine is not as great in power as the sun globe itself. You know, you can get a sunburn from the sun globe, but you can't get a sunburn from a particle of sunshine. You can drown in the Pacific Ocean, but a single drop of water will not drown you, although they all have the same chemical qualities. So we're one in quality with God, but we're different in quantity, and our salvation depends on the acceptance of this reality. Now, I think we're coming to the end here. These are some nice quotes that I found about the soul. I think you'll appreciate them. Mark Twain said, "Be careless in your dress, if you will, but keep a tidy soul." And then this is Plato. Plato and Aristotle and Socrates, their guru, basically the guru of the ancient world, was a man named Pythagoras. And we only know him as having formulated mathematical theory. But he was much more than that. He was basically the sage of the ancient Indo-European world. And it's said that he went to India and he spent time in India. He was definitely a vegetarian. He was continent. He believed in transmigration. And he is said to be the guru, so to speak, of Plato. And here's a quote from Plato. "First, the fallen souls take birth in human forms, the highest of which is that of the philosopher who strives for higher knowledge. If his knowledge becomes perfect, the philosopher can return to an eternal existence. But if he becomes hopelessly entangled in material desires, he descends into the animal species of life. After some time, the soul again attains a human form and another a chance to achieve liberation." So when we come from the spiritual world, we come to a very high position. We're coming from all that glory, so we don't drop way down. We just drop into a very high position in the material world. But then we can degrade ourselves by our attachments. One European said, "We were created a little lower than the angels, and we've been getting lower ever since." Sometimes wealth and opulence are the rope by which we hang ourselves. In Krishna Lila, there were two personalities named Nalakuvari and Manigriva, who Krishna liberated, but they'd been cursed to stand as trees for 100 years because they were very wealthy, the sons of Kuvera, the treasures of the demigod, and they were addicted to intoxication and shamelessly exhibiting themselves naked in public. And so their very opulence caused them to be degraded to the position of trees, although they were very high. William Shakespeare said, "Care I for the limb, the thighs, the stature, bulk, and big semblance of a man? Give me the spirit." Horace, "Why do you hasten to remove anything which hurts your eye, while if something affects your soul, you postpone the cure until next year?" Kushner, he's the fellow that wrote "Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People?" I think his first name is Howard, I'm not sure. "The soul is not a physical entity, but instead refers to everything about us that is not physical. Our values, memories, identity, sense of humor. Since the soul represents the parts of the human being that are not physical, it cannot get sick, it cannot die, it cannot disappear. In short, the soul is immortal." Van Goethe, "The soul is indestructible and its activity will continue through eternity. It is like the sun, which to our eyes seems to set at night, but it has in reality only gone to diffuse its light elsewhere." And A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, "Your grandfathers died, you will also die, and your children will also die. Death is certain, it's only a matter of time. Still, you are madly accumulating money and working very hard all day like a donkey. You do not care for the soul which is eternal, but you care for the body which is temporary. This is ignorance. In ignorance, the soul becomes degraded, and after this life, such people take birth into lower species of life. We are the soul and not this body. The body is temporary, but the soul is eternal and immortal. Thus, the aim of human form of life should be to escape from the fangs of material life, birth, death, disease, and old age. This can only be done by humans who have the higher consciousness. So don't waste this life by getting attached to the bodily platform. This body is just one drop in the ocean of bodies that we are going through." One time a king named Chitraketu, his son died, his little baby son died. And he was inconsolable. He became blind from grief and he was banging off the walls. So he asked one sage, he said, can you bring my son back to life? And the king said, are you sure? Are you sure you really want this? He said, of course I want this. I want him back in life. So the sage says, okay, I'll bring him back. And he brought the soul back into the body of the little child. And the child began to smoke. He said, what? The child woke up and he was angry. He said, what are you doing? He said, what are you doing? And he said, don't you recognize your father? The soul said, I've had so many fathers. What makes you think you're special? So the soul, you know, in my previous verse, I've been passed around from womb to womb, just like spare change, you know, goes from pocket to pocket to pocket. He said, I've had so many fathers, so many mothers. He said, now I was headed for liberation. You want to call me back? What kind of a father, what kind of a well-wisher are you? You know, I was on the path, and then all of a sudden I feel something pull me back to go into this body of mucus and spuel, bile and stool and urine. I think you're doing me a favor, you know? And so, and then the king said, okay, I don't, go. And then that way everyone was, they actually had the right perspective and became consoled. But one thing that the soul said before the soul departed, he confided to the king that in his last life he'd been the enemy of the king. And he took his birth in order to torture the king, to get back at the king for some perceived slight in a previous life. And so this king, who had been out of his mind with grief due to attachment of the body, this incident, and the words from the revived mouth of his son, immediately cut off all his bodily attachments. And after this incident, the soul continued on its journey back home, and the king gave up, and he went to the forest, and he did yoga. He didn't have any interest at all anymore in pursuing, you know, bodily goals. Oh, here's more Prabhupada's quotes. A sword is hanging over your head. It will fall at any moment. All your properties, cars, and big bank balance won't help you at the time of death. Only your service to Lord Krishna will count. So make the best use of this precious life by serving Lord Krishna. All your physics, chemistry, math, computing, and business knowledge will be completely snatched at death. Only spiritual knowledge will go with you. And the topmost spiritual knowledge is the Bhagavad Gita. So don't waste precious time. Read the Bhagavad Gita and attain an immortal spiritual body full of bliss knowledge, eternal, and without a trace of calamity. If we follow the Bhagavad Gita with seriousness, of this there is no doubt. I think we're coming to the end here. Even though the... And this is a verse also, which is a famous verse in the Bhagavad Gita. Abhichet sarachara bhajate. The path of Krishna consciousness is so powerful. It's like the sun that shines on a urinal, a public urinal. I'm sure you probably had this in the Philippines. And in India, it's even worse. Whatever it was like in the Philippines, it's like 100 times worse. You know, that acidic smell, you know, that hits you like a block away, you know. And yet, some or other, the sun rays can purify, given enough time. They can, if they're exposed to a urinal, they will purify. And they'll act in a way that's antiseptic and prophylactic. And so, even if someone does something as a devotee, which the public considers sinful, still, they're considered saintly because the process of devotional service is so powerful that they will become purified. All they have to do is continue on with it and not disengage from devotional service. And that's the end. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.